Hiring isn't just about finding someone willing to take the job. You need the right person with the right background who can move your business forward. If you want candidates who truly match what you're looking for, trust Indeed Sponsored Jobs. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post stands out to quality candidates who actually fit the role. According to Indeed data, 90% are more likely to be hired and trusted by 1.6 million companies. Spend more time interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. Now with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help your job get the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/podcasts12. Just go to Indeed.com/podcasts12 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcasts12. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Do it the right way with Indeed.
Today on The Grave Talks, reuniting with spirits. After experiencing a tragic loss at the age of 8, Tim Miley was left questioning his spiritual beliefs or belief that there was any rhyme or reason to life and death at all. As an adult, once he moved into his own home, Tim would soon discover that the other side was much closer than he thought. He began hearing noises, having experiences that led him down a path to paranormal investigating, leading him on a journey of reconnecting with the loved ones that not only he lost, but helping complete strangers find peace with their lost family members as well.
My interest in the paranormal is probably a little bit different than other people. I grew up in a household where we didn't really talk about the paranormal. Mm-hmm. My dad's family was very religious, and that kind of meant, you know, when you died, you either went to heaven or you went to hell, and there was no need to discuss it any further. I didn't notice the paranormal. I'll say I didn't notice. I probably was inundated or had experienced it, you know, most of my life, but I just never noticed it. Mm-hmm. Until I was 31 years old. I bought a home in Oshkosh, Wisconsin, here where I still live, and within a couple of weeks I had all these things happening. I had bangs on the wall, I had voices, I had footsteps, and I had no idea what was going on. And at the time I was in a very low place personally, a very dark place personally. My dad passed away when I was very young, and we may touch on that later in the interview, but I was scared. You know, I'm 6'4", 265 pounds, and the first thing I did was call my mommy. I never dealt with anything like that before. And here I was, you know, being forced to, and a lot of my family at that time said, it's your dad. He's coming back to watch over you. So 2006 is the very first time that I dealt with anything that I would consider paranormal, and it opened up an entire new world to me.
That's very interesting. Just for your reference, because I'm sure this will come up at some point, I can probably relate to you on a lot of local area things because I grew up in Fond du Lac. I lived in Oshkosh for years, worked in radio there years ago. I'm in Fayetteville, Arkansas these days, but grew up in the Fox Cities. So
we were practically neighbors.
We were practically, yes. So we probably know many of the same haunting type things. And I was all about ghost stuff back then. I wasn't doing a show back then, but I was on FM radio on stations like WIXX and WPKR and all that late 90s and early 2000s. But 2006, you get to this house, you're having these experiences, and you said you grew up in an environment where, you know, it really wasn't something that was talked about. It really just wasn't part of life. And unless you're having experiences as a child, and you grew up in a house like that, it's not going to be brought up. I mean, I have plenty of friends and family where that's exactly how it was. Their interest is very fleeting because they've never had experiences, and that's just the mindset as to what they were brought up around. So you kind of having that as your background, and then in 06, starting to have these experiences in this house that you got, what is going through your mind initially? I know you said you called your mom right away, but personally to you, how are you processing this? What are you thinking?
I'll be honest with you. I thought I was going crazy.
Mm-hmm.
I thought I was losing my mind. Being in a place where I was really in a deep state of depression at the time, so that didn't help. Mm-hmm. And just dealing with that and trying to process what was happening in the house, and it was dumb luck. I'm a big pro wrestling fan. I think that makes me a little bit weird for most people, but I've watched pro wrestling since I was a kid.
Sure.
And it was just a chance for me to get away, to go into this other world and just forget about everything that was happening in mine for an hour or two. And I happened to be watching wrestling one night, and it was on the Sci-Fi Channel at that time. And on came this commercial for Ghost Hunters. Mm-hmm. And this is how naive I was to all of this. I had no idea there were shows like that. I had no idea there were people that went around and looked for this stuff.
Sure.
So I immediately set the DVR, fell in love with the concept, fell in love with the fact that there were people out there that were willing to help me. Mm-hmm. And then they started talking about Tapp's family members. Mm-hmm. And Tapp's family teams. And I did some research, and I contacted a few teams in Wisconsin, and to my surprise, none of them got back to me. I was not worth any of their time. But it turned out to be a great thing, because had they got back to me and had they come into my house and explained everything, I wouldn't have pushed forward, and I wouldn't have done my own research, and I wouldn't have educated myself, and I wouldn't be in the position I am today. And that position is I get to help a lot of families in Wisconsin, and that's the thing I take most pride in.
Sure. So tell me about that. Tell me about that journey as you began to have to essentially investigate this stuff on your own, because the people you're reaching out to are not reaching back out to you. What do you do? It's got to feel a little bit helpless and a little bit daunting at first, but what do you do to dig into that?
I didn't know where to start, so I wouldn't use my experience as a template. But I went ahead and I found all the documentaries I could. I watched a lot of the TV shows. I started listening to a lot of paranormal radio. I read books that I could get my hands on. And I just tried to absorb as much information as I could. Mm-hmm. And it really was never about starting my own team. It was about my own sanity. Mm-hmm. And explaining to myself what was happening in the house. And as I became more comfortable with the idea of the paranormal and the activity that was happening in my home, I started talking to friends at work. I started talking to family members about what was happening, because even back in 2006, 2007, a lot of times when you bring that subject up, they look at you like you got something hanging from your face.
Yeah.
It's much more accepted now, and that's a wonderful thing. But back then, not so much. You're really playing a game with your reputation there if you brought it up. But
yeah.
About a year into trying to educate myself, like a light bulb went off. And I said, you know, if there's families out there that are looking for help, they're probably not getting their emails answered either.
Yeah.
You know, there should be somebody out there that's willing to help them. And that's really how Fox City's paranormal team became a thing. In January 7th of 2008, we had our first meeting. And I'm the only person that remains from that first meeting, which is probably a good thing because I'm a bit controlling. So, but over the course of the last 12 and a half years, we've had the chance to work with a lot of fantastic people. I owe a lot to people like Todd Arnold, who runs the team with me. Mm-hmm. Since about 6 months into this whole journey, Todd's been by my side the entire time. And then people like Tony Macario, and you know, there's been countless people that have been a part of this team and then left for various reasons, you know, families, you know, starting a family, a new job. Mm-hmm. There's a lot that goes into this, and people don't really understand that. It's very time consuming. We ask a lot of your time, and we're all giving up time away from our family and friends and trying to help people we don't know. So I can't do an interview without thanking all the people that have been a part of Fox City's paranormal team. They've helped us get to this point, and they've made me look very good, and I get to do things like this. I get to talk with you on the radio.
Yeah, I mean, it's very interesting. I mean, it's just the expansion of what has happened over the years in really every state as far as what the paranormal investigative crews look like today as opposed to 2006. In 2006, I lived in a small apartment off of Bowen Street. Actually, it was more about 2005, I think, is when I was there in Oshkosh. And prior to that, I was in Wausau. And in Wausau, is where I had initially contacted Chad Lewis, who's big into paranormal in Wisconsin. And then when I was in Oshkosh, I actually got a chance to meet up with him in Appleton, and we went and investigated a cemetery where there's the Kate Blood gravestone and walked through there at night with a mini disc recorder, because that's what you used in 2005 to record things digitally, and had one hell of an experience there. But it was tough. I mean, it was nowhere near as there weren't as many in terms of volume of people that were out there that were really doing this seriously and could help. I mean, I think a lot of them, honestly, at that time were getting inundated with requests. There was far more people that had interest and had stuff going on than there was people to give any sort of answers or help with any direction. So it's awesome to see that all these years later, a lot of people all kind of got together and said, I'm having stuff too. Let's try and figure out not only our own situations, but others as well, so everybody doesn't feel so damn crazy. I remember the feeling odd. I would, this show that we do now, it was initially kind of, it was created back there in the Fox Cities, well before podcasting was a thing. Every once in a while, not just Halloween, I would do Fox Cities ghost stories on 99.5 WPKR in the evenings. I did the night show there. And I don't know, probably like once a month, far more than you should bring up on a country radio station, ghost stories. I would do it. I just open the lines for a night, and then people would share their ghost stories between me playing Tim McGraw. So I heard all sort of very interesting kind of small tidbits of this and that all over the state. So tell me more about, as you're digging into this house and the strange things that you're hearing and experiencing in your initial case, if you will, what are you finding? What are you using to find evidence? And what did you find in 2006 of the noises in that house?
I never actually investigated my own house.
No,
I did a lot of research here, and along the way, I just resigned myself to the fact that this is my dad, and I started talking to him.
Okay,
just as though he was there, and just got comfortable to the point where, you know, this is dad and whatever else is here is fine. Once I started doing research into the paranormal, I realized that what was happening in my house was very tame, very mild, compared to what other people are experiencing. And real quick, you're going to love this. The last case we did, a residential case in Oshkosh, was on Bowen Street. So we'll probably have to talk after the show is done.
Sure.
It just got to a point where I was comfortable enough. Our very first case was in February of 2008 and was actually a family member. And I'm grateful for that, because I also don't recommend that you start out with a residential case, because there are so many things at that time that I did not know. And if I'm being honest, 12 and a half years later, so many things I still have to learn. This is a never-ending process. Mm-hmm. And if you stop learning, I think the field just goes right by you. But we were able to go into that house, didn't mess up things too badly. Things went well, and really got the ball running and or ball rolling. And we had two cases in the first 6 months of existence. And then we got a couple of cases in the area, and word of mouth, you know, people would say, hey, these guys aren't so bad. You know, they're going to do their best to take care of you and help you all they can. And then we got a call in 2010 about a case that ended up on Paranormal Witness, and everything blew up for us. Mm-hmm. Next thing you know, we're doing about 20 of these a year. And, you know, life changed a lot once that Paranormal Witness episode aired. And I wasn't ready for that. I didn't expect that. For some reason, I thought I would still be in my own little world, my own little bubble. And when it aired, I was getting messages from people that I had watched on TV, mm-hmm. and from people within the paranormal, and it was crazy.
Tell me, let's take a step back before you even got to that first house that you investigated. How did you essentially kind of check the box for yourself mentally to feel confident enough to say, okay, I'm ready to go into someone else's house, to go into someone else's, you know, residence, without having, you know, a lot of times people jump into this having, you know, almost apprenticed, if you will, underneath another team or were with another team. You not having necessarily that opportunity, but you doing all the research on your own to the point of saying, okay, I think I have some knowledge here. I think I can help people. What did you do to get up to that point, to that confidence level to say, I want to go into your house and I'm going to do my darndest to try and help you?
I wish I had a good answer for you, but I think it was just blissful ignorance.
Yeah.
For some reason, once I started researching all of this stuff, I just had this ultimate confidence that if we were going to do this, then there were going to be families that were going to count on us. And I had to do my very best and just be overprepared. Mm-hmm. And I guess so going into that first investigation, just overpreparedness and confidence in the people around me. And the fact that it was a family member made it a little bit easier. There wasn't quite as much pressure there. But doing that first investigation gave me even more confidence in the mission, mm-hmm. That we wanted to accomplish. And, you know, from day one, it's been all about helping as many families as we can. I'm not the guy to talk to if you want to talk about well-known haunted sites all around the country, because a lot of them I have not been to.
Sure.
My focus has always been on families, mm-hmm. and that's kind of our calling card, and I'm proud of that.
And those are some of the most interesting cases to me. We talk on this show, on the Grave Talks, to folks who have some of the most well-known hauntings, you know, ever. Amityville, Conjuring, you name it. But and those are very compelling. I mean, some of those I've been drawn to since I was a little, you know, little kid, specifically Amityville, and to be able to talk to some of the people who were firsthand witnesses to it is very compelling. But oftentimes it's these small stories that may not and I say small in terms of their publicity, not in terms of what happened within the case. A lot of times people don't want to be known. They don't want their story out there. Or if it does get out there, they don't want anybody to know who it is or where it is. You can tell the story, but that's it. No evidence as to where this actually happened. Those to me are sometimes some of the scariest, most compelling stories that are out there. And then inevitably, then once we air it, then we get calls on our end from every TV producer going, can you give me the lead on who that is? Because we'd love to use that in an episode of this show. And my answer is usually probably not, unless they really want it to, because I can usually know firsthand if they already wanted it to be out there or not. Tell me about this before you get to going in and doing the investigating, being brought up with a belief system that really, you know, wasn't paranormal friendly, for lack of any other better way to say it. Did you have to do any sort of internal reckoning with your belief system to really accommodate this, to take it into a level of seriousness, to take it into a level of inquisitiveness where you're not too scared to go and dive into this because of what it could be, or to take it at a serious level where, shit, this stuff is going on for people? I mean, how did you reckon with that, or was that almost kind of out of you by the time you started investigating?
I kind of got to go backwards and explain, you know, where a lot of this came from.
Yeah.
I was raised Lutheran.
Okay.
Until the age of 8.
Yep.
And that's when my dad, unfortunately, while putting out cones at my elementary school, got hit by a construction vehicle.
Oh, wow.
And ended up being in a coma for 6.5 years, mm-hmm. passed away from the injuries when I was 15. Mm-hmm. I gave up religion. I gave up believing in a higher power at that point. Mm-hmm. My thought as a young child was, you know, what kind of God takes away my father?
Sure.
So I was angry. I didn't want anything to do with organized religion. I didn't want anything to do with talking about anything with that whatsoever.
Yeah.
And it's very strange because the paranormal field brought me back to belief, brought me back to spirituality.
Yeah.
And believing in that higher power, and all things happen for a reason. I wish it would have happened a different way. It's really strange when I tell people this, but I have a better relationship with my dad now that he's gone than I ever had when I was a kid, because I'd only knew him till the age of 8. Mm-hmm. And I have a lot of friends that are mediums, and it was kind of a running gag for me when I would go to events. I would talk to my dad and say, hey, this medium here, is he or she for real? And And I would say, hey, you know, have them give me this message. And 9 times out of 10, they did. And it was incredible. And it was a game for me and my dad, and I loved it. But I digress. Mm-hmm. So getting into this, it wasn't necessarily – I wasn't conflicted in my beliefs because at the time I really didn't have many.
Sure.
The paranormal field – and this is going to sound hokey as hell, but the paranormal field has made me a better person. Mm-hmm. It's made me care about people other than myself. And I'm thankful every day that all of this happened. It's wild and crazy how everything has happened. But
yeah.
But getting into the paranormal field, like I said, I grew as a person, and everything I read about and everything I watched and just soaked in as much as I could brought me back to that point where I was comfortable in saying, okay, this happened for a reason. We got to move forward. And this is what I'm supposed to do with my life.
Yeah. That's a great answer to the question. And it's very interesting to hear your story on that. And I can relate in some ways too, where it has made me more spiritual as well. I also brought up Lutheran. I did not have a tragedy like you went through, and I totally understand how you would feel. That makes total sense. I would probably have done the exact same thing. I just kind of naturally moved away from it in general. Just kind of like, I don't know. I just didn't necessarily believe in organized religion. And I don't necessarily know how much I do, honestly, to this day, but I believe there's something out there. And you don't necessarily need to go to the building on a certain day of the week to have that in your life. But it has certainly made me go, having heard all these stories and everything, to go, there is, it's taken me from that young 20s of there is no anything to there's certainly something. There's certainly something going on here, because there's no way all these people are having these experiences, and more so I'm trying to find answers, and I know I'm going to always end up by the time I'm dead with more questions than answers, but certainly many more stories than I otherwise would never have heard. I can relate on the better person thing too. Just being able to share these stories, and inadvertently, I started doing this the other podcast, Real Ghost Stories Online, just to hear stories for entertainment and see how that goes, and just because I like the topic. But it turned out it ended up being like group therapy for the paranormally affected, as we've joked. Just because people are able to get their stories out and not feel alone. And that, to me, is what drives my interest in this more than anything, is helping folks not feel alone, because so many have these stories. And the more people talk about it, the easier it becomes for everyone who has one of these things to come out and say, look, I got this going on too, and I'm not crazy. Tell me more about when you jumped into that first investigation. It was a family member. What were you investigating? What were they reporting to you, and what did you find?
They were reporting that they thought it was a family member at the time. She thought it was her brother. That's what we went in to investigate. They had they had doors opening. They had footsteps happening. Again, very mild, and probably a great time to do our first investigation. And that night, being novices, we did mess up. We had a door open. And on the audio, you can hear the latch actually open, and you could see the door open, but our camera placement was not the best, and it never really is. Even 12 and a half years later, we don't seem to get anything on camera. But we sat there and watched this door open, and it was pretty incredible. It was pretty amazing. But just trying to investigate what you think is your uncle, you have to remove yourself from it emotionally.
Sure.
And for the rest of the team members, they didn't have that problem. But it was a good first investigation. And like I said, not a whole lot went wrong. After we were there, they did report that the power tools would randomly go on and off in the basement. And just basically told them to, you know, have a discussion with whatever was in the basement. Easy for me to say.
Sure.
And asked them not to do that. And they didn't have it happen after that. I don't like using the word haunting, I guess. Very mild activity in the home. And we were able to document a little bit of that. And and move us forward as a team.
What was your reaction to finding out that sometimes just the most simple of actions of saying to someone, just reason with it, just say out loud, like you were talking to them as if they were alive and standing in the room, ask them to stop doing something, that is one of the most effective tools in dealing with the paranormal. To me, when I learned that, or when people started saying that on the show, I was shocked. I was always, you know, I grew up on Unsolved Mysteries. I grew up on all that sort of stuff. And so when it was always presented, it was like investigators came in and they did this and that, and they brought the priest in. And then, you know, you're expecting there to have to be this whole hoopla and dog and pony show to get something accomplished. But sometimes it's not anywhere near that to communicate or deal or reason or live comfortably with the dead.
It's pretty wild, isn't it? You know, the simplest of things. And I relate it to when I first started talking to my dad, and the fact that I could just sit and have, you know, a one-sided conversation, because I can't hear him talk back. But there are so many times when I just sit and talk to my father. So I try to relate it in the most compassionate way I can to the family. And that's another aspect of paranormal investigation that some teams need to get a little bit better at, in my opinion. We have to have compassion for that client. They've gotten to the point where it's bad enough in their home that they're willing to bring in four strangers and let them walk around in their house for a weekend.
Yeah.
You know, that's pretty incredible that, you know, that's where they are in their life, where they're willing to let people that have never been in their home, they don't know, come in and try to talk to, you know, loved ones, people that used to live there, spirits that have passed, and whatever it is. Mm-hmm. Just being able to give them hope, you know, and saying, hey, just reason with it. Mm-hmm. And having it work. I mean, it's, like I said, it's pretty wild. It's crazy to think that we're able to do that. You know, 12 and a half years later, it's kind of become something that I don't even think about.
Sure.
You know, until you ask that question, it's like, it's just become old hat, you know? But when you first start giving that advice, I think there is a moment when you step back and go, you know, am I doing the best I can for this family, or am I just repeating something that I've heard and trying to kind of walk my way through this?
What were some of the mistakes that you made early on, have maybe not even early on, but just mistakes that you've made over the years, inadvertently? Obviously, you're trying your best to help these folks, but have you ever looked back on something and said, you know, maybe I should have done something a different way or a different approach to the investigating or trying to communicate with something?
I am so critical of my own work that I think there's not a case that goes by that I don't look back and go, I could have done that differently. Mm-hmm. But I guess the biggest one for me is it took a long time for my brain to process the fact that, okay, that there may not be anything happening, or there might not seem like there's anything happening tonight. But we truly don't know that until we listen to the audio back or watch the video. And there have been a lot of cases where I think internally I've given up. Mm-hmm. And you go back and you listen to the audio and, you know, holy crap, you know, we have all these voices that were trying to communicate with us. And here I was, you know, giving it 3/4 effort because I was just ready to pack everything up and go home. But there's little things on every case, every investigation, not the night of, but when I'm listening to the audio, I'll hear myself say something and I'll cringe and I'll go, why did I say it that way? Mm-hmm. You know, it's just little things like that. And we're never going to be perfect. You know, this isn't an exact science. But like I said, those people are counting on us. They bring us into their home and they're looking for answers. So you want to do the best you can for them.
Tell me about the paranormal witness case or the episode that you were involved in. How did that end up getting the attention of the television series? How did that relationship and how did that investigation begin with you?
All started in 2010. We got called into a home in Chilton, which if you lived in Fond du Lac, you know where Chilton is.
Yes.
Got called into a home in Chilton. Actually worked on that case for 2 years. And just you become a part of their family. Mm-hmm. And the gist of the case, and I'm not going to, like, I'll give you the short version.
Okay.
There was a little boy, he was 2 years old, was put into foster care in 1967. A week or two after he was put into foster care, he was rushed to the hospital and pronounced dead, and they ruled it strenuous child's play. So 1967, this happened. So we got called in 2010. So 43 years later, this family is seeing this little boy, hearing this little boy. And then they're also seeing and hearing an older man, an older gentleman. They start doing some research on the home, and they find out that that there was a boy that was, you know, obviously I told you already, there was a boy that was murdered in the home in 1967. And like I said, they originally found it to be strenuous child's play. In 2005, the case got reopened by his biological siblings, and it was now ruled a homicide, mm-hmm. and that the foster father was the one that had actually molested and murdered this little boy. It was a very, very sad situation.
Yeah.
Going into the first investigation there, we didn't know that last part. We just knew that there was a boy there, and we didn't know exactly what happened to lead up to this.
Yeah.
We were called in. It was an emergency situation. We went in with very little research. During that initial investigation, we were told over audio to go home, and also that a voice said murder in the basement.
Mm-hmm.
So we made plans to go in 2 weeks later. The client did a great service to us, did some research, found that newspaper article. In that newspaper article, they said that the boy's name was Walter Kristen, and he went by Chris. So that night, we tried to do whatever we could to make him comfortable, because this is a two-year-old boy. I'm a pretty big guy. You want to make yourself as less threatening as you can, because you just got to treat these spirits as if they're people. And if you walk up to a two-year-old boy and you're towering over him, he's not going to talk to you.
Yeah.
So we did everything we could to make him trust us, and that was big for us. And that night I asked him, do you want us to call you Walter? Do you want us to call you Chris? And we actually have audio of a little boy saying, my name is Chris. And that was the single most heartbreaking piece of audio I've ever listened to in my life. And just knowing that, you know, he was there and all that he had gone through, because we knew the story now. Fast forward to, I believe, April of 2012. It's been a long time, so the timeline kind of escapes me sometimes. Sure. But I had just started doing paranormal radio, and the owner of the radio station, his name was Scotty Rourke, pretty well-known medium here in Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
And Scotty and I started talking, and I'd heard all these great things about Scotty and how fantastic he was as a medium. So I took a shot in the dark. We had never worked with a medium before, because a lot of the mediums I had met up until that point, I didn't trust a whole lot.
Sure.
But I started asking Scotty if he'd help us on this residential case. And he immediately said, yes. He said, I don't want to know anything more. You know, don't tell me anything. Just give me your address. He came over to my house. And it was that night that I learned that it really, truly was my father in the home, in my home.
Mm-hmm.
But we got done eating and we sat in the living room, and he looked at me and he said, your dad wants me to tell you something, but I'm not sure he wants me to tell you in front of everybody. And it was just my team members, and they're like family to me. And he said, your dad's upset you told him to leave. And there was a night where my dog was scared, and I looked to my left and I said, you know, dad, it's okay. I'm going to be all right. You know, you can go now.
Mm-hmm.
Biggest lie I ever told my dad in my life. But, anyway, getting back to the story, we went from Oshkosh to Chilton. No matter which way you go around Winnebago, it's about 45 minutes.
Sure.
So we're on our way, and, my co-founder Todd is in the back seat with Scotty, and Scotty is mapping out the house on his knee and telling us where everything had happened, where we need to be. And Todd is not responding, but I can tell something big is happening in the back seat, but I'm driving. We get to the home, and he takes us to the exact spots where we had the activity. And that night, Scotty did transmediumship, which if I had not been there, I wouldn't believe. But we were able to speak to Chris, and it was an amazing experience. One of only two spirits we've ever helped cross over. And I guess it was probably about 4 or 5 months later, I got a call from Scotty, and he said, "Hey, I got a call from Raw Entertainment. They want to know if there's any cases, residential cases, that I would recommend for their show." Mm-hmm. And he said, "I gave him your name. Just talk to him."
Sure.
And it took a long time for me to even agree to that, because it's never really been about TV for me.
Yeah.
It's, you know, after doing some soul searching and talking to the family, because I would have never done it without their blessing.
Yeah.
I decided, you know what? I want Chris's story to be told.
Sure.
You know, I want people to know about this little boy. So we agreed to do the show, and there was a lot of exaggeration on the final product.
Sure.
But they kept their promise, and they told his story, and they kept it intact. So I was happy with that. But it was an experience. I don't want to be too down on the experience, but it was a process, and I tried to stick to my guns and keep the integrity of that investigation and Chris's story, and I'm glad it happened, because it opened up a lot of doors for us. Like, mm-hmm. I said, all of a sudden people thought we were legitimate. I thought we were pretty okay before all of that, but it opened up doors, and it helped us help a lot more families in the Wisconsin area, and for that I'm grateful.
Television can almost be like a double-edged sword when it comes to the paranormal, in my opinion. In some cases, in one way, it opens up the topic. It makes it more approachable for many people to talk about, even if the cases that are being presented are overly exaggerated for television and essentially have gotten into the hands of the producer, and the producer is just trying to figure out what's going to keep eyeballs there. I get it. I've worked in television. I know how it works. I've done TV. But, you know, at the same case, you know, you're trying to keep the integrity of the story, but ultimately it's going to come down to some network executive saying, make it more spooky. And then they have to do what they have to do, which kind of sucks. But at the same time, we wouldn't have the open conversations that we can have today with more people without these stories getting out there in some way, shape, or form. What was your goal going into that case before TV ever obviously became a part of it, when you were just one-on-one with the family, and before you even had the experience of the transmedium that was coming in there and talking and having that conversation with the child, you as an investigator, what is your goal? What was your goal at that time with that specific case of going in to investigate? Is it always to try and help something cross over? Is it just to give people the peace of mind that they're not crazy, that yes, you found something too? What is it for you?
The top priorities for me going into an investigation are, A, we have to help the family, and B, if we can help the spirit, we have to do that too.
Mm-hmm.
So it was about helping the family. And then once we learned that, yes, there really was a 2-year-old boy here, a spirit, I became so emotionally attached to that case. I can tell you honestly, for 2 years, every day I thought about that case. I was obsessed with it. I needed to help this little boy. And it became very personal for me, because I wanted him to get vindication. There was even a point during that last investigation with Scotty where Scotty gave me the opportunity to talk to the old man that had done this. And I don't provoke as a rule, but that night I let loose, and I don't remember a lot of what I said.
Mm-hmm.
But I said everything that I thought that little boy should have been able to tell him.
Yeah.
And he took all of the happiness and innocence away from that little boy. And in my mind, he deserved everything he was going to get, which is, it's not funny, haha, but funny that it led to a conversation with Scotty and I, because Scotty doesn't believe in hell.
Okay.
Scotty believes everybody gets another opportunity. Everybody gets a second chance. And I was making the argument for Chris that, no, you know, this man did these horrible things to him. He deserves to pay. He deserves to suffer for what he did.
Sure.
And in my mind, that was the end goal in that investigation. I wanted vindication for that little boy. So it became less about the investigation for me and more about the, telling the story for this little boy, because I thought he really deserved it.
Was, you said when you let loose on that man that was the perpetrator on the little boy, was his spirit in that building too?
Scotty kept telling me that yes, he was there and he was afraid to move on.
So simultaneously was the spirit of this little boy cohabitating with his perpetrator in this house, even in death.
Yeah. 45 years of it.
Yeah.
It was walking into that house. I'll be honest. When you walked into the basement, it was like a gut punch. It took everything out of you. And, that night, talking to the two of them separately, the little boy was, it was amazing just having the opportunity, because going in, Scotty didn't have any of the names. None of this stuff is ever on our website, so we don't put anything on there. So he had no way of looking anything up. But he came up with the little boy's name and, you know, was telling us things that we had brought up on previous investigations while he was talking to us through this little boy. And it was amazing but heartbreaking at the same time. And I'll be honest, you asked if I had any regrets on investigations. I look back to that investigation that last night that we were there. One of my biggest regrets is, like, for the next year and a half I was chasing the next Chris case. And the cases we were getting, although they were very important to the family and for them it was a big deal, for me they weren't reaching the level of Chris, so I was disappointed until I finally woke up and said, you know what, these cases are just important to this family as the Chris case was to the other family. And we got to make sure that we're giving the same effort on every case. And so, yeah, that's one of my biggest regrets too. But experiencing that case from 2010 to 2012 was just, it changes you as a person. It really does.
With the energy that you said, you know, you walked through the door and you just felt it. Is that energy, was it that way because of, I mean, essentially you have a child predator and murderer living in a house with the child that he perpetrated on and murdered in the same house, and they're both spirits. I mean, if you had two living people who, I guess you take murder out of the equation as not being part of it, but you have a child predator living in a house with the child, you're going to have weird energy there if they're living. Add murder to the mix and they're both dead. Is that what created just that weird anxiety, dark feeling of the two of them still being forced to kind of cohabitate and not know what to do, not know where to go, but they're both dead and they're both in the same place and they both know what has happened with each other?
I believe you're 100% right. Yeah. I will tell you this, once the investigation was done and we felt like we had moved the little boy on and the older man actually moved on too, I never say where because that's not my job or not my place to tell you where they went. I mean, that's people's individual beliefs. I just know they're not in the house anymore. I still keep in contact with that family. They're still doing good. There's still nothing happening there. But after all of that, and we went up to the living room, that was the most heavy hour of my life, probably. And we went up to the living room, and I bet you we laughed for about 15 minutes. Mm-hmm. It was just a release.
Yeah,
it was a release of all of the nervous energy and all of the darkness that we had experienced, and it just all came out and everybody just kind of looked at each other. We hugged each other a lot. There were tears and then we just laughed and we just let it all out. And it seems like the strangest reaction to one of the most heavy experiences of your life. But in that moment, that's what we all needed. And it was a night that the six of us will never forget.
You had said earlier, it's not your place to say, you know, when someone crosses over or whatever term you want to use there, they've moved on to say where it goes. But I'm just curious, opinion wise, and this you can give your answer of what you believe, because I'm always curious from investigative standpoints and investigators, what do they believe? You're exactly right. It is up to anyone to fill in that blank there. But when you feel that this boy crossed over, and I'm going to ask you the same thing of the perpetrating man, too. Where do you believe they crossed over to? Or what's your opinion? Where do you think, you know, obviously it is 100% opinion. Where do you think they crossed over to? Or what happens at that point once they're out of the house?
For me, I think it is heaven.
Okay.
That's my personal belief. I want to believe that that 2-year-old boy is enjoying life up there, and he can finally smile. He can finally laugh. As for where the older man went, I might seem spiteful, but I still hope he paid for what he did.
Sure.
Because he never paid for it during life. By the time they overruled and found it to be a homicide, the older man was already gone.
Yeah.
So never really paid for what he did to this little boy. And if he did that to that one little boy, how many other little kids did he do that to? Yeah. You know, that's the bigger part of it. It was just a very sad case. But yeah, for me, I revert back to growing up until I was 8 years old and heaven and hell. And, and for me, heaven makes sense because I'd like to believe that my dad is up there. And I'd like to believe that my little boy Murray's up there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So for me, it's heaven.
Yeah. And I totally understand both directions of where, because if someone didn't get justice here on Earth, you hope that there's some sort of justice on the other side. I'm totally with you there. You hope that he is the person, and I don't think it's spiteful. I think it's just human nature. And those of us who have the streak in our personality of justice oriented, I'm very much like that too. You want something to have happened. There should be some sort of justice. I don't know if that's what happens. If for some reason they do get the second chance, as one of the other investigators you were working with, you know, says that they believe that that's happened. I don't think my mind can process that. I don't think my mind is very good at processing, oh, you get a second chance, even though you were this horrible fucking beast of a human being. Why do you get a second chance? But, you know, it's not for us to set those rules. It's just for us to try and understand what's happening. But I get you. I would totally hope for the same. You have mentioned your father quite a bit and saying that you feel like you have a better relationship with him now that he's passed on. And I think we'll close our interview in asking this question. Do you feel like your father is helping you investigate these cases and go on the journey that you're going down? I know sometimes when you said you've talked to mediums or folks who are able to do that, it's almost been kind of a game sometimes. And that's fun. That's interesting to hear how that transpired. But do you think he comes to you? Do you think he's helping you on this journey of investigating the paranormal and the supernatural and the dead as you go about and visit all these folks who need your help?
I not only believe that, but I'll do you one better.
Yeah.
I think he's the one that pushed me to do this, from the beginning. I think, since he was the spirit that was making all of the noise in my house in 2006, I think it was his plan that this is what his boy was going to do. Mm-hmm. And this was my calling. And with that comes, I don't want to disappoint my dad. So, I better do this to the best of my abilities.
That wraps up our conversation with paranormal investigator Tim Miley of Fox City's Paranormal, back on my old home turf in Wisconsin. To find out more, look up Fox City's Paranormal. Until next time, for The Grave Talks, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for your support, and thanks for listening.
Mr. Monopoly here. Monopoly is back at McDonald's. Register in the McDonald's app so you're ready to
get your bag.
Two ways to peel for a chance to
get your bag.
Physical peels with select items and digital peels with others to
get your bag.
Play Monopoly at McDonald's.
Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
No purchase necessary. See rules at playatmcd.com for full details and amoe.playatmcd.com to play without purchase. Ends November 23rd, but bonus play ends November 2nd. Monopoly is a registered trademark of Hasbro. Copyright McDonald's.